Welcome to KDNK's Weekly Newsreel,
a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. The Weekly Newsreel is underwritten by RJ Paddywax Pet Outfitters, next to City Market in Elgebel. Open 7 days a week. More info at 970-963-1700 or rjpaddywax.com.
I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. Headlines this week included COVID spikes and reopening woes, Bureau of Land Management changes, Amtrak changes, and a Food and Drug Administration warning about hand sanitizers.
The Food and Drug Administration has issued an advisory to not use hand sanitizers containing methanol due to its toxic effects. Substantial methanol exposure can result in nausea, vomiting, headache, blurred vision, permanent blindness, seizures, coma, permanent damage to the nervous system, or death. Products that might contain methanol are made by Esk Biochem. The FDA says to stop using these products and don't flush or pour them down the drain.
Amtrak says it's cutting service on two rail lines through Colorado to run only 3 times a week because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The Southwest Chief and the California Zephyr currently run daily. The Zephyr comes through Glenwood Springs. Mayor Jonathan Godis says the cut would hurt the city's already suffering tourism economy.
People from all over the country use that Zephyr line to get to Glenwood and to recreate, including my own mother. And so it'll be really disappointing if those cuts go through.
Amtrak says ridership has fallen by 90% across the country. The cuts are set to take effect this fall.
Governor Jared Polis signed 2 bills that will create funding for small and micro businesses. The Basalt Chamber of Commerce reports that one sets up a grant program for businesses with fewer than 25 employees. The other bill sets up a loan program for businesses with up to 100 employees. These funds will also help those who may not have been able to get a Paycheck Protection Program or PPP loan. The governor also named a new 5-member Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission on Monday. The new paid commissioners will replace the 9 members who have overseen Senate Bill 181 rulemakings for the past year. Current COGCC Director Jeff Robbins will become commission chair. Julie Murphy, Chief of Staff and Senior Policy Advisor for COGCC, will take over as director July 1st. The other 4 members are from the private and public sectors. Health officials in Eagle County found a cluster of new COVID-19 cases in the past week among teenagers, reports 9 News. 11 out of 26 new confirmed cases were among people between the ages of 16 and 18 in the Roaring Fork Valley. Health officials said that many were infected after attending private social gatherings, and some have been unwilling to isolate at home or help contact tracers.
Garfield County health officials have also seen a spike in new cases of the virus in the past week, which could put the county's variants from the state in jeopardy. The county is now at 244 cases since the pandemic began, with 44 diagnosed between June 8th and the 21st. The variants could be rescinded if the county sees 60 cases in any 2-week period. The county's move into the next statewide reopening phase could also be at risk. The state may not allow counties with a high level of disease transmission to move into the next stage. Garfield County has jumped from low to high risk in a short period of time.
Pickin County bars will not reopen at 25% capacity for at least a few weeks, reports Aspen Daily News. There are 15 drinking establishments in the county, and they will have to remain closed due to a recent spike in county COVID numbers. Pickin County reported 5 new cases of the virus on Thursday.
The U.S. Drought Monitor reports that extreme drought conditions now cover a large part of southern and eastern Colorado. The Natural Resources Conservation Service released a report this week that shows an average of 1/10 of an inch of snowpack remaining throughout the state. Snowpack in southwest Colorado melted out 2 to 3 weeks ahead of its normal schedule. Scant rain in May and June has also increased wildfire concerns. The Denver Channel reports that Governor Polis on Monday activated the state's drought task force and the drought plan for 40 counties, including Garfield, Eagle, and Pitkin.
Glenwood Springs city crews worked until 2 in the morning Thursday to repair a broken raw water line and a section of Red Mountain Drive that was damaged after the line ruptured Wednesday morning. Water tanks began refilling at midnight, and morning crews continued to recharge and test the system. The broken water line is about 50 years old and made of ductile iron. City officials say the repair could cost $25,000. A midday press release said the Eagle Sanitation District and Glenwood Springs Hot Springs Pool helped with pipe fittings and a section of new pipe.
Toklot Gallery in Basalt ends a decades-long run at the end of June. The Aspen Times reports that owner Lynn Mace has decided to close the gallery and is selling off all inventory. The Mace family opened Toklot Wilderness Lodge near Ashcroft in 1949 and had galleries in Aspen and at the family home for close to 40 years. The gallery moved to Basalt in 2005.
William Perry Pendley has been the acting deputy director for policy and programs at the Bureau of Land Management since July 2019. Now, President Trump plans to nominate him as the director of the agency. The Center for Western Priorities, a conservation and advocacy group based in Colorado, has called for a confirmation hearing. Pendley ran the conservative Denver-based Mountain States Legal Foundation for 30 years, practiced law in the Washington, D.C. area, and served in the Reagan administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Energy and Minerals. High Country News reports that Pendley has been in favor of privatizing public lands. Pendley oversaw the recent move of BLM headquarters to Grand Junction. News was mixed this week, with at least two protests in the area, which we'll get to later in the program. But first, KDNK's Kathleen Shannon visited the Carbondale Pool and the Rec Center and spoke with Community Center and Recreation Programs Manager Jesse Rochelle about how the pandemic has changed some procedures.
So these days we're open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. You do have to reserve a spot online or by calling in. We prop the front door open so that you don't have to touch the handles. And then we're open for an hour and a half, and then we close for a half hour for cleaning, or open for an hour and a half, close for a half hour for cleaning.
That means visitors have 1.5 hour time slots to work out. Visitors are required to wear masks when entering and leaving the rec center, but they may remove them when they arrive at their exercise station. There's a plexiglass shield in place to protect a receptionist, and the furniture in the lobby has been removed to discourage gathering.
And then we've restructured how all of our equipment is in here. Our basketball gymnasium is no longer a basketball gymnasium or an event space. Now it has all of our cardio equipment. And we've taped off 12 by 12 foot zones to keep everybody socially distanced. So you can sign up for a treadmill or an elliptical or a bicycle. And then within your zone, if you want a mat or some free weights, we can get that for you.
There's a similar setup in what has become the dedicated weight room. For now, the climbing wall is still closed, and there are restrictions in the bathrooms and showers as well. In total, the rec center was closed for more than 2.5 months due to COVID-19. Rochelle says she's happy with the guidance the center received while determining how to reopen.
I think we're really fortunate that our Parks and Rec director and also our town manager took a pretty conservative stance with us reopening. It was really nice to test things out and see if this new system was going to work with the time slot reservations and how things were spaced out. I think that, you know, our upper management was playing it smart by not expecting us to just jump all in and do everything we've done in the past.
The influx of visitors is slowly increasing, though Rochelle says the overall numbers are significantly lower than they'd usually be. Rochelle's team has been designing and sending out at-home workouts free of charge, and it's hoping to start fitness classes within the next couple months. The center has gotten some programming off the ground.
We just started youth programs this week. We've added some youth hikes and youth tennis. And so registration is open for those. And so that was exciting. Now it actually kind of feels like summer for us, being able to offer some outdoor programming. And we did open our outdoor public pool this week. Each week or month, we are trying to do a little bit more without doing too much.
I'm Margaret Donnelly, and I'm the Health and Wellness and Aquatics Coordinator for Carbondale Recreation and Community Center. So right now it's the morning, there's lap swim, We can also have a little section of the pool for a family who's actually waiting at the gate about to come in. And then in the afternoon, we take the lap lanes and we move them to the center. And so then we divide the pool lengthwise and families can come in. So you're essentially reserving a section of the pool for an hour and 15 minutes.
Swimmers can now find entry and exit gates into the pool area from Sopras Park. The front door is staying locked at this point. Much like in the rec center, visitors will find a marked one-way path around the pool, and they should wear masks en route into and out of the facility. Visitors should also arrive in swimming attire, as dressing rooms are currently unavailable. The pool's only been open for a few days, and Donnelly says time slots are starting to fill.
It's kind of hit or miss. I think as word gets out, it'll spread a little bit more and it'll get a little bit more full each day.
Both the rec center and the pool have changed their pricing models as well. More at carbondalerec.com. For KDNK News, I'm Kathleen Shannon.
You're listening to the Weekly News Reel, featuring top stories aired between Monday and Friday. In-kind support comes from Grassroots Community Network, promoting civic participation through civil discourse, creative endeavors, and cultural interaction. More info at grassrootstv.org.
Testing, test, testing, testing. On Wednesday, 350 Colorado hosted a webinar to discuss trends in regenerative agriculture with researchers from the University of Colorado Boulder and Colorado State University. Wendy Peters Machete of Live Well Colorado spoke about the group's rebranding and the Colorado Farm and Food System response team.
I always really question the notion, the inbuilt assumption that our conventional current industrial food system and production models are actually efficient. We waste so much food, and they're really only efficient if you measure them in terms of calories produced, but not necessarily in terms of nutrition produced or nourishment considered more broadly.
Presenter Nicole Savita, an instructor at the University of Colorado Boulder, describes regenerative agriculture as going beyond sustainability to promote resilience and redemption for ecosystems as well as communities.
I'm really talking about intentions and actions that continually enhance the vitality of a place, a person, a community, or a system. A lot of what we moved to over the last several decades to try to do less harm than what we now call conventional agriculture hasn't quite succeeded because much of it has drifted towards the model that we've been trying to replace. And so rather than just trying to do less harm, we actually want to shift towards thinking about whether we can feed ourselves and do good and be net positive.
Doing good to have a net positive involves addressing social ailments produced by our dominant food system in addition to continual environmental degradation.
We want to think about our food systems as tools for poverty alleviation, community building, and even individual empowerment, as sites for engagement.
Savita sees the COVID crisis as a disruption and therefore a time of possibility for establishing a healthier foundation for meeting our society's most essential needs.
Our 13th Amendment, when it ended slavery, carved out a really big exception for those who were convicted of a felony. And so we still have what is functionally slave labor in our food system in the United States. I don't think we can be regenerative without taking on these acts of redemption as well. We need to end agricultural exceptionalism and really start pulling back on the ways in which our environmental and labor laws just simply don't apply to lots of agricultural activity. Or agriculture and food system employers, or don't apply evenly, and make sure we get protections for our agricultural and food system workers.
A steady increase in interest for locally produced food supports these possibilities, as affirmed by Dr. Don Thilmany, professor of agricultural and resource economics with Colorado State University.
It's moved beyond farmers markets and CSAs and roadside stands, although a lot of people still love those, to having new innovations like food hubs throughout the country, who are also trying to make it easier for us to get those into schools and hospitals. The other thing we've really noticed is, besides the marketplace, just a really strong interest in bringing a new policy dimension to our discussions about where food fits into our society.
The presentation concluded with an announcement from Wendy Peters Moschetti, Director of Strategic Initiatives for Live Well Colorado. This organization, responsible for healthy food incentive programs like Double Up Food Bucks, will soon be rebranding as Nourish Colorado.
That will probably launch August 1st. So we have a new name, logo, mission, vision, transforming food systems is our tagline. So Live Well Colorado, as you know it, is going to be retired. So more coming on that.
Colorado Farm and Food System Response Team, made up of 14 organizations, including Live Well Colorado, responded to the onset of this pandemic with a small grants program. $140,000 was awarded in the first round, with $200,000 more to be distributed among applicants currently under review for round two. The remaining $190,000 for round three will focus on infrastructure for rebuilding a more resilient future. The full presentation is available on 350 Colorado's Facebook page. Information about joining their Regenerative Agriculture Committee is at 350.org under the Get Involved tab. For KDNK News, I'm Raleigh Burley.
And now for the protests. The discovery of a newly built road in a designated roadless area brought protesters to the Paonia District Office of the Gunnison National Forest earlier this month. KDNK's Kathleen Shannon reports.
So let's put this in a moral context. When you go along to get along in a situation that you know is wrong, you're no damn good. Thank you.
That was one of roughly 90 people protesting last week outside the Paonia District Office of the Gunnison National Forest. The nonprofit EcoFlight captured aerial photos of about 1 mile of newly constructed road through the protected Sunset Roadless area. The road was built by Mountain Coal Company, a subsidiary of Arch Resources, formerly known as Arch Coal, that operates the West Elk Coal Mine in Somerset. The mine consists of more than 20 square acres of national forest land and is Colorado's single largest industrial polluter of methane. Mountain Coal has been trying to expand mine operations into the roadless area since 2010.
We pay the Forest Service, we pay their salaries, they are supposed to be upholding the law. And Arch Coal is blatantly disregarding the law and busting a road into a roadless area, a beautiful chunk of forest. And they're breaking the law.
That's protester Kirsten Atkins. The protest was organized at the front door of the National Forest Service office because protesters link Mountain Coal's actions to the Trump administration, saying that the U.S. Forest Service turned a blind eye to the road construction. Frustrations mounted when District Ranger Levi Broyles stood at the center of the circling crowd and answered questions like this.
Have you observed the fight?
I have an employee who has been out there almost every day.
And what is he doing out there? Is he directing the bulldozers or is he just observing?
Or is he citing them, taking enforcement actions for their illegal activity?
I'm not allowed to discuss that.
There is a long and bumpy legal history in the Sunset Roadless area. In 2012, the Colorado Roadless Rule designated 4.2 million acres of protected roadless areas within the Colorado National Forest System. That is, with one notable departure. What's known as the North Fork Exception was designed specifically to allow for coal exploration in the North Fork Valley. Conservation groups have brought Mountain Coal to court repeatedly since then. When the groups fought a 2016 mine expansion proposal, the district court sided with the mine. But this March, a Denver Court of Appeals overturned that decision and ordered the district court to quash the North Fork exception. This was a big win for the conservation groups, until last week's discovery of the new road and the conclusion that the court's decision is not being enforced.
unfortunately, it's pretty clear that this administration is trying to find loopholes or in this case, maybe just outright ignore the court in kind of an all-out effort to develop fossil fuel. There's this energy dominance agenda from the Trump administration that's, you know, essentially steamrolling all other uses and values on public lands, ignoring the input of local communities and even local agency staff. And so in a lot of ways, it feels like a continuation of a pattern we've seen across the West.
That's Will Rausch, executive director of Wilderness Workshop, one of the conservation groups involved in the litigation. To the protesters, it looks like Mountain Coal took advantage of the court's slow timing, bringing in the skid steers after the appeals court made its ruling, but before the district court officially vacated their decision early last week. These groups have already fought and won in court. So what can they do when Mountain Coal acts outside of the ruling?
We filed an emergency motion with the federal appeals court, you know, asking them to enforce the order right away. And then we also filed a motion with the U.S. District Court in Denver, that's the lower court, asking them to finalize the order from the higher court vacating the exception. So kind of two different actions at two different levels.
Upon the conservation group's request, the Colorado Division of Reclamation and Mine Safety issued an order to Mountain Coal Company June 17th to cease road construction and tree removal. Mountain Coal maintains that the road is not illegal, reports the Colorado Sun, and says that it did consult with the Forest Service before starting work. Protesters fear that this road and the Forest Service's potential role in it could set a precedent.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I live in Paonia, and basically it was like, red flag, red flag, red flag. Yeah, this is pretty blatant. I think this will be a place where they're showing the breaking down of the law. And that's critical for everybody, because if it happens in one place and it goes unchecked, it will continue to happen in more and more places unchecked.
For KDNK News, I'm Kathleen Shannon.
And finally, last Friday marked the 155th anniversary of Juneteenth, the effective end of slavery in the United States. Residents from the Colorado River and Roaring Fork Valleys gathered in Rifle to speak out against police brutality and systemic racism. They were met with another group of protesters, some carrying firearms and flags, and others on loud motorcycles. KDNK's Lucas Turner reports.
It's Friday, June 19th in Rifle, Colorado, and aside from all the people standing around with signs, a heavy police presence and scores of motorcycles, things are, for the most part, pretty normal. Traffic lines up along Railroad Avenue, Rifle's primary thoroughfare. It's 6 p.m. and many commuters are just pulling into town as their work week effectively ends. The street is packed, and so are the sidewalks. The bulk of activity is near the downtown area on 3rd Street, where people stand in blue shirts of all shades, waving American and Trump 2020 flags, sporting pistols, assault rifles, and some even wearing tactical military gear. A bit further up the street, motorcycles line up in empty parking lots. All of these people came here for the counter-protest organized by a local business owner who wanted to show support for the police. Their message is back our blue, and they wait patiently for some sort of interaction with protesters gathered nearby at City Hall.
The counter-protesters?
Counter-protesters? We just got here. Uh-oh, SpaghettiOs.
That's Monica and Mason, a set of twins who live in the Silt, Newcastle area. Mason carries a large sign, one of many in the crowd.
It says, law enforcement needs better psychological evaluations.
Mason says he understands the perspective of both sides, but wants to see better screening during the hiring process for new police recruits. His twin sister Monica makes the case that current police culture and recruiting policies seem to attract some aggressive personalities.
That is not necessarily what we want to see in people who are supposed to be protecting us.
Yeah.
So therefore, we think that they need to have better psychological evaluations. They shouldn't be quick on their feet to attack people. They should be able to think and process clearly in order to help people.
Monica and Mason speak with me just before organized begin rallying the crowd. It starts with a brief history lesson, recognizing the historical significance of June 19th.
Today is formally known as Juneteenth, the day that all enslaved Americans were finally set free. And of course, today is a day of celebration and to rejoice the fight that was put by African Americans long, long, long ago.
One of the event's main organizers takes time to strategize before the march begins. He reminds the crowd to stay peaceful, even if antagonized, and to hold each other accountable.
So they are on both sides of the sidewalk, it seems. Do not interact. Do not interact. Do not give them the fuel that they want. If they are blocking your way, simply walk past them. Don't touch them. Don't do anything. They touch you, walk away. That may not be the thing we want to do right now, but it's the thing we have to do. Yes.
The protesters follow two chant leaders saying Black Lives Matter. Almost immediately, counter-protesters can be heard chanting in response.
USA! 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 USA!
Online events promoting both protests shared information about opposing protests sticking to opposite sides of the street, but the counter-protesters are everywhere. It's not long before both groups are in close contact, trying to drown each other out. While protesters have been asked to stick to the sidewalk, another group has access to the street, the people who showed up on motorcycles. The bikers drive by slowly, coming in waves. Some even take multiple trips. Others find parking spots along the path to Rifle Police Department, where they back in, position their bikes' exhaust valves as close to the sidewalk as possible, in preparation. When protesters arrive, the throttles open up. Technically, it's loud enough to cause hearing damage, but chants can still be heard through the din. Eventually, the march turns right. It's not far to an empty parking lot outside the Rifle Police Department. At this point, police officers step in to separate and put space between the two groups. Chanting continues with renewed energy.
So again, we want to thank each and every one of you for coming out and marching with us. That was a lot more chaotic than we thought it'd be. There was a lot more to deal with than we planned for, but I think we handled it well. I think it went well.
That's Omar Hernandez from Rifle. He's one of the protest's main organizers. He says he hopes to see more peaceful protesting and increased turnout in the future. He also speaks about the presence of counter-protesters.
I think a lot of them aren't really sure what we're here to do. We weren't necessarily anti-police. We were pro-Black Lives. And a lot of the things we said weren't against the police department themselves. We understand that the police department here in Rifle is nothing like the police department anywhere else in the world where things like this are happening. But I don't think they understand that. We are not here to start a riot. We are not here to incite violence. We are just here to spread awareness and spread a message. That is our main goal, and I think we accomplished that. So no matter what they did, I feel we were successful today.
We'll share more sounds, speeches, and interviews from the Juneteenth protest in Rifle next week on a special public affairs program. And you can see a number of images from the day taken by KDNK reporter Amy Haddon Marsh at KDNK.org. KDNK News, I'm Lucas Turner.
That does it for this week's newsreel on KDNK. All of our stories and more are at KDNK.org. The Weekly Newsreel is a news magazine that takes a look at the week's top local and regional news stories aired on KDNK between Monday and Friday. Subscribe to our podcast and give us a review on iTunes. If you have a tip on something you'd like the KDNK news team to cover, send it to news@kdnk.org. All submissions are confidential. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening and have a great week.